6:05 on a Wednesday, hump day. Lloyd, hump good morning. Day.
Good morning, sir.
It's good to see you.
Good to be seen.
Did you get a little wet yesterday?
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
It was a little soaking outside. It was soaked yesterday.
You know, it's funny. My one son is done with school for the year. My other is finishing up this year. So my little guy goes to my mom's during the day.
Okay.
And so I went to pick him up. And, of course, we had T-ball last night.
Of course
so
you
I'm
did.
I'm watching the radar to see. I got parents texting me. Are we still going tonight? And I'm like, I don't know. Haven't heard. I think we're still playing.
Uh-huh.
But I was at my mom's house, which is about 20 minutes east of where I live, and it was a monsoon. At her house in Novi. An absolute monsoon. And so I was like, all right, well, we're going to be canceling this thing.
Yeah.
Called my wife. I'm like, how's it looking over there? She's like, it's fine. I'm like, all right, I guess we're playing. So we did play. It was very muggy.
Muggy,
hot.
Yeah. Muggy this morning, too.
The bugs were out. A lot of bugs flying around the ballpark.
Sure.
But we did have some weather roll through.
Yeah, and man, Southeast Michigan had some 40-mile-an-hour winds and coming through along with those storms yesterday, and it disrupted travel and sports. The severe weather triggered a ground stop for all inbound flights at Detroit Metro. It forced a delay of the Tigers game at Comerica Park. I know my son called me. He was like, Dad, you know, because he was there with his granddaughter. My granddaughter. And he was like, you know, it was supposed to start at 6:40. Now they're saying 8:30. And so, you know, we're just kind of hanging out. I was like, okay. The evening storms follow this turbulent afternoon where the National Weather Service confirmed two tornadoes touched down further north, damaging up to 40 homes near Freeland. No injuries were reported. Metro Detroiters won't get a break from the elements as a heat advisory takes effect today. High humidity expected to push the heat index values up to 100 degrees alongside the threat of more severe storms through tomorrow.
So
get ready.
Your granddaughter wanted to see Kevin McGonigal.
Yes.
He did have a walk last night.
Yeah,
quiet stat line for Kevin McGonigal.
Won.
But they did win 10-4. And Dylan Dingler hit a couple of home runs. So
yeah.
The fireworks were there.
Hold it. Dingler, what is his number?
What is his?
His jersey number.
His jersey number. Yeah. He is number 13 for the
Detroit Tigers. She wanted to see. My bad, because she's turning 13. Her birthday is Friday.
Screw Kevin McGonigal.
So she got to see who she needed
to
see.
Good. Well, then even better.
That's right, because my son says he's getting her a jersey because his jersey is 13. She'll be 13 on Friday.
That's very cool.
That's
well, then good. Then she got a show from Dylan Dingler last night.
I know it was
night.
A D. It was one with a D.
Three runs scored, two hits, four RBI, and two home runs for Dylan Dingler last night.
Oh, man, she got a birthday present right there.
Yeah, slugging percentage up to .528 for Dylan Dingler. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good for Dylan Dingler. Meanwhile, the latest on Iran, yesterday we learned post-show that the president came out and said the U.S. Army Apache helicopter went down during that patrol near the Strait of Hormuz. He says it was shot down by Iran. So the United States engaged in what they called proportional defensive airstrikes. They targeted Iranian airbase systems, radar sites, and military control centers along the Gulf Coast, including near Bandar Abbas and Keshem Island. Iran quickly hit back. They launched U.S. Missiles and drones at U.S.-aligned targets across the region in Bahrain and Kuwait, where air defense systems were activated, all
sure.
good there.
Yeah.
But again, this is all while the ceasefire is in place. So once the United States realized and learned and confirmed that the Apache helicopter was shot down by Iran, well, they had to respond.
Well, at one point, the president said yesterday that them shooting down was not a big deal. No big deal.
I don't understand.
I don't get that part, you know, but they did retaliate.
Yes,
know.
As they should have.
As they should have.
And CENTCOM came out and said, at the direction of the commander-in-chief,
yes,
we are responding.
Absolutely, which is what they should have done. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But this isn't, you know, what it feels like to me is if you take it at its face, you're like, okay, it's a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
But now Iran has taken these actions multiple times.
Right.
You know, they have taken military action while the ceasefire has been in place, more so now with Israel. But now the United States is involved here. And again, the fear of escalation.
I mean, so are we really in a ceasefire?
Well,
at this point?
I think so.
Even though we're
so.
Firing at each other?
Yes, because it could get, I mean, this could be well, much worse in terms of military action. I mean, we could be fully engaged again.
I get it, but if it's a ceasefire, that means you're ceasing fire.
That's fair. It's a fair point.
But they're not.
That's so fair. Not,
so is there a ceasefire now? That's all I'm saying.
Counsel, you have been heard. You rest your case.
Thank you. I rest my case. Drop the mic.
Yeah.
Four adults are dead following a shooting inside a Livonia home last night. Police responded to reports of gunfire about just before 6 o'clock in the 19,000 block of Rensselaer Street near 7 Mile Road. Upon arrival, officers detained a suspect who emerged from the home with their hands raised. Inside, police discovered two victims dead from gunshot wounds in a bedroom, two more victims dead in the backyard. Investigators recovered a firearm at the scene. They say the suspect lived at the residence. Three of the victims are believed to be family members, with the fourth was in a relationship with someone in the home. Police emphasize there is no ongoing threat to the public as the investigation continues. They were calling it a mass shooting yesterday, and we didn't have a lot of information, but now we found out that this is, it seems more like a domestic situation because they're family members.
Right.
You know, they're related, and, you know, so.
Yeah, the gunman wasn't targeting people in the community.
No, exactly.
Like that,
but, that's right.
I mean, regardless.
Regardless, it's still a sad situation.
I mean, you
sad situation.
Four people shot to death.
Yes, right. Yeah, that's a sad situation.
Meanwhile, as we head on out to Capitol Hill, the House narrowly passed that major budget reconciliation bill focused on immigration enforcement and funding ICE and CBP. It's a big win for Republicans. This is what they had been working for after there was a funding announcement, at least a partial funding announcement for DHS during the partial government shutdown. 214 to 212, almost entirely along party lines. The core of the bill is that $70 billion in funding for immigration and customs enforcement and border patrol. And these were the last pieces of funding for DHS, which is now in place. And they were able to use reconciliation, which means they didn't need, they were able to pass things in the Senate with a simple majority. It broke the filibuster for Democrats, so they weren't able to do much with it. But Republicans are saying at this point that this is, it's more security, it is more resources, and it is pouring a lot of money into these agencies that need the money to continue the immigration enforcement that this administration has put forth. At the same time, Democrats are saying, well, hold on, you had two people shot in Minneapolis because your operations were out of control, and we've accomplished nothing in terms of oversight or reform changes, things like that. So that's where we stand. Dodd's going to head to Donald Trump's desk, and he is going to sign it.
The Rocket Classic is leaving the PGA Tour. Tour officials and Rocket companies confirmed that the upcoming 2026 tournament, scheduled for July 30th through August 2nd at the Detroit Golf Club, will be its eighth and final run. Rocket companies declined to exercise its option for 2027, citing imminent changes to the PGA Tour schedule, sagging attendance, and difficulty drawing marquee players. The decision ends billionaire Dan Gilbert's 13-year run as tour sponsor, an investment totaling more than $150 million. While the PGA Tour says it remains interested in the Detroit market, it must now search for a new venue and a new corporate sponsor.
Yeah, that's a tough mountain to climb.
It is.
It's a shame to see it go.
It is, man. It was not only was it a great tournament, but it was also great for the community because they gave back.
Yeah, what, $10 million?
Yes.
So, I mean, there's no doubt. It is one of the great things about the PGA Tour, and this stop in particular. I mean, the charitable efforts that are tied to these tournaments are spectacular.
They
do make a big difference in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of, you know, the rejuvenation of this city, and certainly this tournament has played a role in that.
Connectivity was one of the big deals with this one.
Bridging that digital divide.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, certainly. Coming up on the other side, three deaths at the Huron Valley Correctional Facility, the women's prison. What is going on there? Debbie Dingell's got the same question. It's next on JR Morning. Here's your chance to win a trip to see Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind, and Fire in the city of your choice. We've got flights, hotel, concert tickets, and premium VIP lounge access covered. It's your chance to sing along all night long with Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind, and Fire. Prizes provided by Live Nation. Text this hour's national keyword, LADY, to 95819. That's LADY to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Play four times each weekday for four chances to win. Official rules and more information is at WJR.com. Meanwhile, three women have died within about 3 weeks at Michigan's only women's prison.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the exact causes of their death is unknown, but the pattern is raising some serious concerns for medical care in particular, and the response times and the overall conditions inside the facility. These are some of the questions that Congresswoman Debbie Dingell wants answers to. Congresswoman, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning to both of you. I hope you are having a good Wednesday morning.
We are.
So far, so good.
We are. It's still early, but so far, so good.
I would be having a better one if I was at home. So.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Fair enough. Let's talk a little bit about this. What are you asking the governor for here in this instance?
Look, I want to say that there have been questions about this prison for years. There have been reports of mold. There have been health problems. I've heard many other reports. I actually went into the prison last year. Heidi Washington, the head of the corrections bureau, came to the meeting. The head of health care for the prison system was there. There were a whole host of important people at the meeting, and I was joined by approximately 10 state legislators, state senators, and state House members from Washtenaw County, from my district, who've been asking questions for a long time. They gave us a lot of, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, promised to give us some information. But the complaints have continued. The state legislature has had hearings. A lot of things came out. But then in the last 3 weeks, there have been three deaths. I've talked to the families of two of them. When I got the call this weekend that a third person had died, I just totally kicked in the stomach. People aren't getting answers. And there are a lot of issues, but the two issues I've focused on in my letter is, and trust me, I've talked to many, many people inside the Whitmer administration about what the issues are. One is how healthcare is being handled. When are people seeing the doctor? What happens if they've got a serious condition? How is medicine being given? How are they being treated? Crystal Clark is one of the inmates that's really, she's got toxic mold on her ears, her face. That's who when we went in the prison the last time, she was actually there. We met with her doctors. And they're, you know, the information gets inconsistent. But there's also a lot of allegations made about mold, black mold, the state of the facility itself, and are people getting sick from the environmental issues. There were studies several years ago that indicated there may have been black mold. The state has been testing and saying that it's okay, but that they're not being made public. Now, the governor's office says we can't because the AG's office says we can't release it. Well, I told her, go work with the AG's office, because this is a matter of transparency. We need to be holding them accountable to what they're telling us, but we need the facts. Look, the people there have been, they're in there serving a sentence, and we recognize that, but they need to be served with humanity. There are issues here that people need to be kept in a safe environment and given medical care. And there are other good things going on there with Eastern trying to help educate many of the students, give them another occupation. But when your the physical place you are in may be a threat to your health, and when medical care is not being given that takes care of you and people are dying, you need the facts.
Congresswoman, you got about 30 state lawmakers who are now calling for the resignation of the MDOC director, Heidi Washington. Do you believe leadership changes are necessary to restore public trust?
Well, I have a different answer to that. I think something's got to change. But if you replace the head of it and you don't understand the issues and everybody around you isn't going to make change, that doesn't take care of the problem. So I want answers. I want to know what's going on, why we're not being given the truth, what's happening. And then we need to look at the whole system and who's got what responsibilities and whose responsibilities aren't being done.
I also wanted to ask you about the reconciliation package that was passed in the House yesterday. CBP ICE is now funded for really the remainder of the president's term here. It was a reconciliation bill, and you got that bill from the Senate. What were your impressions of that bill? Because, you know, quite frankly, the partial government shutdown with DHS, I thought was ridiculous. It was unnecessary. But at the end of the day, there is still funding for these departments.
So I voted against it, but for many reasons. I mean, I can give you the obvious ones, that inside of it is the $1.8 billion, or there can still be a fund to give people that were convicted of attacking police officers settlements, which I think is absolutely insane, unethical. But the bigger issue you're talking about, as you asked me this question, Chris, is that they're funded for 3 years. I think we got to stop making TSA and some of these other agencies that work very hard to keep us safe every day. And what those TSA agents have gone through, I know them, not having money to pay for food or gas to get to work. I have introduced legislation to get them out of this mess. But the bill that passed is much more like, it doesn't have any guardrails for ICE. It doesn't have things that we need to do to probably be keeping us safer. And at the same time, unfortunately, it could cause more shutdowns in other areas. So I don't think it was good policy. Mm. And I'm going to still fight to have guardrails on ICE. You know, I want the criminals off the street just like you do, but I don't want to see any more shootings like the ones we saw in Minneapolis. And I think cameras on vests and a number of other, just what every other law enforcement officer has to do, should be applied to.
I think everybody would agree with
100%,
that. 100%. Yeah, certainly. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, we appreciate your time as always. Thank you. And we'll
Thank
talk
you,
again
gentlemen.
Soon. Yeah, you got it.
Have a good day.
Yep, you too. Coming up on the other side, we're looking at gas prices down and then up a little bit. Patrick DeHaan joins us. So the average cost of a gallon of gas here in Michigan, according to AAA, today is $4.22. The national average is $4.16. So we're hovering right around the national average.
Yeah,
pretty
absolutely.
Good. Mm-hmm. But gasoline prices are falling even as crude prices are rising. Why is that happening? Patrick DeHaan, the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com, joins us. Patrick, good to have you back. Why are they falling as crude's rising?
Well, they actually just went up. Across Michigan, we saw prices going up to $4.39 yesterday afternoon. So a lot of the time that AAA data is a day behind, but that's what happened late yesterday afternoon. So we finally saw a little bit of a jump across Metro Detroit. Average prices are only up about a penny as those numbers are updating in real time. But most stations across Metro Detroit now back at $4.39. So we enjoyed a little bit of a lull there. Prices had come down for 3 weeks on the hope that there'd be a deal between the U.S. and Iran. But prices can only fall so far while oil prices remain, you know, still quite a bit above where they were a few months ago, $90 a barrel this morning. Thankfully, it's still lower than $115 a barrel like it was a month and a half ago. Mm-hmm. But some of the refining issues that also pushed prices up considerably in late April and early May, those refining issues have been sorted out as well. So gasoline, even though it's up today to $4.39, that's still quite a bit lower than $4.99 like it was in late April. And diesel prices have come down by over 50 cents a gallon as well since basically late April. So refining issues improved. Oil prices remain relatively low, but a little bit of a jump at the pump after several weeks of declining prices.
Patrick, we continue to see significant price differences across the state. You know, why are drivers in places like, you know, Ann Arbor and here in Metro Detroit paying considerably more than those in Flint or Lansing?
Well, as I mentioned, most states did make that jump up yesterday, but when prices go down so significantly, stations can lower prices either faster or slower, just depending on if they want to be real aggressive. And with prices have been, above normal prices in the last 3 months because of the whole situation, some stations may not be in a hurry to lower prices and fear that prices could go right back up. So whenever you see such a huge decline in the price of oil, it really all comes down to competition, how quickly competitors will start undercutting each other. And that's why when prices do go down, you shouldn't rest on your laurels. That's actually when you have a potentially more likelihood of overpaying by not shopping around for those sub $4 prices that did pop up.
How does OPEC factor into all of this? Are we seeing the ramifications of the UAE leaving OPEC Does that play a role for us here in the United States?
It probably won't play much of a role until the straits reopen or until that's sorted out. But I mean, that is a pretty big deal that's been masked by what's happened. You know, now talking about OPEC, the interesting thing here that while the situation, the U.S.-Iran situation has been ongoing 3 months now, the Saudis have been moving record amounts of oil through their east-west pipeline. That's a pipeline that basically has just been sitting mostly idle for years as a backup plan. And that's part of the reason why oil prices likely haven't been impacted to a more significant degree is the Saudis are spending about 7 million barrels a day of oil. They're redirecting it away from the Persian Gulf over to the Red Sea. And that is part of why oil prices haven't gone up more. In addition, China has really reduced imports, not necessarily reduced consumption, but they've cut back on imports. And that's another reason why prices today aren't probably higher than they would have been otherwise.
Summer travel season is underway, Patrick. And if these current conditions hold, where do you see gas prices here in Michigan heading, let's say, by the 4th of July?
Well, you know, it's very troublesome to try and predict this. You know, you probably heard a lot of oil executives. Chevron CEO had said, we could see $150 oil. And they're not necessarily wrong. It's just very difficult to know how all of the events are going to unfold here in the weeks ahead. I still worry that as we are releasing oil from our strategic reserves at record rate, that eventually there will come a time when oil prices slingshot. But I just don't know if that slingshot is going to be, you know, July or if it's going to take until August. But in the backdrop of all of this, the U.S. Strategic Reserve, as we're talking this morning, the data is going to take another few days to show this. But my bet is at some point here in the last 24 hours up to this morning that the Strategic Reserve is now at its lowest level since it was filled up back in 1983. And that in and of itself isn't cause for panic, but it's highlighting the uncertainty over, well, when the releases are over, there's not going to be as much oil on the global market. So it's very difficult to predict where we'll be for July 4. I tend to believe that somewhere between $3.99 to $4.99 is where we'll be. Hopefully not above that, but there still is that possibility.
Interesting. Just breaking a couple of minutes ago, according to the New York Times, U.S. exports and services rose 2.6% in April as exports of oil and petroleum products have kicked up too. So how does that play into what we're seeing?
Well, the U.S. is selling more of its oil overseas. And that's putting upward pressure, or generally will put upward pressure on what you and I are paying. Oil companies can sell to the highest bidder, just like when your house is on the market. The goal of selling your house is to whoever is willing to pay the highest offer. And so other countries are trying to buy more U.S. oil to feed their refineries. They're also buying U.S. gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. You know, I'm sure most folks have heard about the jet fuel issues that have been brewing in Europe. Now, most of those have been mitigated by airlines that are trying to increase efficiency. But yeah, the more of our products flow overseas, the more pressure there is on what you and I are paying, simply because it's diverting the product that would be sitting in our supplies, and it's sending them abroad. So there's a double-edged sword here. When the president says, you know, come buy our oil, that does put upward pressure on what we're all paying.
Interesting stuff as always, Patrick Dahan. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it. Well, $10 million has been given by the federal and state government to help clean up the sediment in the Detroit River. This is something that's been talked about for a long time.
Detroit
River needs a little bit of an upgrade, maybe.
Man.
A little facelift, a little TLC.
Yes.
As you will. So how long is this going to take? Well, Sam Nofke is the senior aquatic biologist at the Michigan Department of Environmental, Great Lakes, and Energy, or EGLE. Sam, good morning. It's good to have you.
Yeah, good to be here.
How far is $10 million going to go in this effort?
Yeah, so, excuse me, this $10 million is really just focusing right now on that, what we are classifying as the Harbortown shoreline and the Harbortown upstream shoreline, which is basically, the Harbortown shoreline is basically from the former Joe Louis Arena area kind of up to the MacArthur Bridge. Mm-hmm. And then the Harbortown upstream area is from the MacArthur Bridge kind of up to, you know, around the Conner Creek area. And we're really kind of focusing on that Conner Creek area. But the $10 million is really to conduct a feasibility study and a remedial design for both of those areas. So, you know, not necessarily, you know, a remedial action or dredging or, you know, capping or anything like that. It's just to figure out exactly what needs to be done and how to do it.
You know, for decades, Sam, I know, I mean, I've been here all my life, and people view the Detroit River as polluted and beyond repair. When you look at it today, how different is the river compared to what it was in the 70s and 80s?
Well, I mean, you know, you look at the water, it looks pretty nice.
Yeah.
But, but the sediments, I mean, that's what I'm, you know, that's what my focus is. And you know, the sediments over the years, you know, from, you know, back in the day with the heavy, you know, industrialization of the, you know, the city of Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, really it hasn't changed much. I mean, the sediments don't necessarily, you know, move. So, you know, a lot of the contamination that you know, we're tasked to address, you know, it's been there. It's what we consider legacy contamination.
Yeah.
And that contamination, you know, that's been there from, you know, the turn of the century.
So what is the process of cleaning that look like? What do you do?
Yeah, so I guess this whole remediation process, I mean, I've been working on the Detroit River, since 2013, you know, the state and EPA started sampling sediments back in 2013, just to characterize the sediments. So mm-hmm. we're just taking samples and just trying to figure out what's there and where it is. So, you know, we've collected sediments throughout the entire Detroit River, so we've got, you know, six focus areas or target areas, and so we are, you know, in the process of just kind of moving that forward. Mm-hmm. You know, our one of my current projects, you know, we're just finishing up some remedial investigation work on the river, and so this is just the next step. You know, is moving forward to feasibility, and this is kind of the first area of the river where we're moving forward with, you know, the feasibility, like I said, to really kind of figure out, you know, how to address the sediments themselves.
And you know, Sam, one thing people may not realize is that the Detroit River is actually part of the Great Lakes system. So how important is this river to the overall health of the Great Lakes?
Oh yeah, I mean it's important. I mean, you know, the Detroit River is a, you know, obviously a connecting channel, it's a pretty heavily used connecting channel. I mean, I think anyone that lives, you know, around the city and, you know, will see that, you know, it gets, you know, fished heavily, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, that we do what we do is, you know, we want to ensure that, you know, the use of the river is, you know, safe for not only now, but, you know, for future generations.
Interesting stuff. Glad that there's going to be money dedicated to this.
Yes.
Certainly. And all the good work that you're doing at Eagle. Sam Nofke, thank you so much for your time. We'll talk again very soon.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, for years, I mean, people have talked about the Detroit River. Yeah, you know, it looks clear, it looks clean looking on the surface, but
right.
It's that sediment, man. And, you know, people were saying, you know, years ago, like, you don't drown in the Detroit River, you just get polluted to death.
Yeah.
You know, and now hopefully they can clean that up and get that going, man. And, you know, it is part of the Great Lakes, and you want to keep all of that healthy. And so to do that, you got to look. But, you know, some are saying, though, Chris, that it's going to cost, like, eventually, about $1 billion.
Yeah, more than $10 million.
Yeah, yeah. To do yeah. it. So, you know.
No, but look, I think it's the attempts to get it going, right? It's
you got to start somewhere.
It's the making sure that you're continuing to survey it.
Yes.
Keep an eye on it. Watch what's happening down on the surface of the riverbed. And then, right, then you're going to have to, it's going to take more.
It's going to take more.
It's going to take substantially more money. You know, one of the accounts that I follow on social media is this AI of how these major cities came to be.
Okay.
So it starts, you know, in the woods. Mm-hmm. It's just Detroit is a wooded area with a body of water running through it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you start to see over the centuries the industrialization, the building up of the communities, the buildings, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's in that area where you a lot of the factories are there. Mm-hmm. And what were they doing with all of that? They were dumping it into the river.
In the river. I mean, look, right there at Belle Isle at the MacArthur Bridge, that spot right there where they're going to be building the WNBA.
Yes.
That was Uniroyal Tire.
Right.
That was Uniroyal right there.
Yeah.
You know, so they had to do a lot of cleanup over there at that site.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that it's being addressed.
Yeah. Definitely.
Because the Riverwalk is getting, the riverfront is getting a complete upgrade, right?
It's getting upgraded.
It is unrecognizable from what was when you were probably a kid.
You couldn't get to it.
Right. Right. it's like, what riverfront?
Oh, man, you got to go to other cities. And man, I wish we could get to our water like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about this? For the first time, Americans are getting more of their electricity from solar than coal. That is pretty interesting as well. Also, this is China's passenger car exports surged 73% in May compared to the same time last year, over 800,000 vehicles. And this is a lot of these are EVs because of the higher gas prices.
I would pretty much bet. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, not here. We're not getting those exports here.
No.
But it shows you what China's doing.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. They're making those cheaper vehicles, man, and boy, they would love to get them over here.
You know, and one of the other things I think that when people talk about this issue with Chinese vehicles, like, we're not worried about Chinese vehicles coming here. Like, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. But the realities are, it's obviously would be damaging to the automotive industry.
Yes.
We know that.
Yeah.
But one of the things, I remember talking to somebody in the Department of Justice many years ago, and one of the things they told me was, it is obvious that China is our number one adversary.
Mm-hmm.
They are the biggest threat to the United States, and it's them, and it's not even close for a second.
Right.
And one of the things that they do is, they told me, they infiltrate from within.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy shares of American companies like AMC or Smithfield Foods.
Land. Yeah.
Or TikTok or whatever.
Yes.
Right? This may be a part of that. If they're able to
get cars and
economically impact you
with
cheap stuff.
And surveil, too. And surveil.
And surveil, absolutely. Yeah. 7 o'clock hour coming up. Chris Alberta joins us. All these AI companies going public. 7 o'clock hour. Good to have you. Weather played a little factor into yesterday, didn't it?
Oh, boy. Yeah, it did. It stopped a couple of things. Kind of halted the Tigers game for a little bit.
Yep.
Also, it triggered a ground stop for all inbound flights at Detroit Metro. It was a tornado warning for Wayne County for not long, a few minutes, and then they canceled it. But the National Weather Service said there were two tornadoes that touched down further north, like near Freeland. So we did have a couple of tornadoes touch down as a part of that storm. Now, today we got that heat advisory.
Yeah, it's going to be hot today.
You know, those heat indexes into the hundreds, you know, and some more stormy weather. So just be on the lookout. Be careful.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, the latest between the United States and Iran is an escalation. That U.S. Army Apache helicopter that we talked about yesterday, it was the first rescue of its kind using a Navy sea drone to rescue these two pilots that were operating
unmanned,
Apache. Yeah, the sea drone was unmanned.
Mm-hmm.
And they were rescued within 2 hours. So that's amazing
pretty
stuff.
Quick.
Yeah. But the fact that there was an escalation, because after the show yesterday, the president confirmed that Iran did shoot down that Apache drone. We don't know exactly how. They're still looking into that. But within hours of that confirmation, the United States responded what they called proportional defensive airstrikes. And what did they target? Well, defense systems, radar sites, military control centers along that Gulf Coast. And then Iran hit back to different U.S. aligned targets in the region as well. So, you know, the ceasefire continues as we stand here today, despite your very accurate description of what a ceasefire is.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Look, I see how you're looking at me. You're making me sound crazy. But you're right. You're right. Is this a real ceasefire if you're indeed firing? But it's still in place. Okay. But it just feels like, you know that sweater that you have around Christmas time?
Okay.
And there's that little string that's hanging out.
Uh-huh.
And you're pulling it.
And you pull it, and then it just kind of unravels. Like,
oh, my God, wait, my sweater is just.
And next thing you know, you got a big hole.
It's like an episode of Peanuts or something. Right. All of a sudden, you got no shirt on.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, wait a second, what happened here? It just feels like we're just pulling at that thread. And that sweater is just disappearing somehow. So what that means, I don't know. But they're still engaged in talks. There's still mediator discussions happening. You know, the president is still very much set on some sort of diplomatic solution here. But, yeah, that was an escalation yesterday, certainly.
Dozens of former Michigan lawmakers are drawing six-figure pensions decades after leaving office, sparking concerns over a $200 million taxpayer liability. Now, public records from March of 2026 reveal that 41 retirees or their surviving spouses now receive more than $100,000 annually. The fund, which closed to new members in 1997, is currently only 40.6% funded, significantly lower than other state retirement systems. A guaranteed 4% annual cost of living increase has ballooned these payouts over time. Experts warn that while the fund has historically relied on investment income, current and future lawmakers will eventually have to use taxpayer money to cover the shortfall. Mm.
These are Republicans and Democrats alike.
Yes.
It's not a partisan issue.
No, it's not.
But there is a lot of money coming out of this, certainly. Also, yesterday, the House passed the reconciliation bill that they had been working on to fund Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Border Patrol. They locked in that $70 billion funding that originated in the Senate. And again, reconciliation means they just needed a simple majority.
Yeah.
And the filibuster was not in play for Democrats there. But there are a number of things in this bill that initially were going to be in that weren't going to be in, or at least that were talked about after the reconciliation discussion started, which was money for the ballroom, and other funds. The SAVE Act was going to be a part of this at one point, but those got fleshed out, and now you're looking at a vast majority of the $70 billion going to fund ICE and CBP for the rest of Donald Trump's term here in his second term. And that passed by two votes, 214 to 212, mostly party line.
Sure.
And there was one independent from California that caucuses with Republicans that voted against it. But again, it shows you the thin margin that Republicans
Very
are working
thin.
With right now.
Yes.
In addition to it being a partisan issue. Democrats say they didn't get any sort of say in reforms or
any
sort of check and balance coming out of Minneapolis.
And the shutdown. What did they get out of the shutdown?
It literally zero.
Yeah, they didn't get anything out of the
literally
shutdown.
Nothing. And you had people waiting in line for hours on end at airports. TSA wasn't getting paid.
Right.
It's absolutely ridiculous. So if you missed our conversation with Debbie Dingell earlier, you can go to WJR.com, check that out. But one of the things that she says she's working on is removing TSA, for example,
yes,
from these funding fights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it befuddles me how we use these folks as political pawns when really their whole job is to keep people safe when they travel. So.
Right. The Michigan Court of Appeals has vacated the conviction of a Jackson County man tied to the 2020 plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer, ordering a new trial. Joseph Morrison had been convicted in 2022 of gang membership, felony firearm, and providing material support for terrorist acts. He was sentenced to up to 20 years in prison. But a three-judge panel ruled yesterday that under Michigan law, kidnapping does not qualify as a violent felony for purposes of a terrorism charge, meaning the jury may have been instructed on an invalid legal basis. The court said that error could have tainted the verdict and therefore vacated all related convictions and sent the case back to Jackson County Circuit Court. And prosecutors sharply criticizing the ruling and say they plan to appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court, while Morrison's attorney called the decision a victory for justice. Now, the ruling marks another major setback in prosecutions tied to the Whitmer kidnapping conspiracy case.
7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. How's the small business community feeling these days? Well, suffice to say, the news isn't so good on that front. The National Federation of Independent Businesses said its Small Business Optimism Index fell 0.6 points to 95.3 in May. That's the weakest reading since October 2024 and the third straight month below the metric's 52-year average of 98. And the NFIB's Uncertainty Index rose 3 points to 91, more than 23 points above its long-run average of 68. So what specifically is bringing small business owners down these days? Here's what the survey shows. For one, it's high fuel costs. They're bringing us down for sure. NFIB chief economist Bill Dunkelberg said in a statement, more small business owners are struggling with significant and unpredictable hikes in fuel prices, which are more challenging for small businesses to pass on to their customers compared with their larger corporate competitors. And it's not just the high price of gas. Inflation's prominence as a pain point continued to grow, with 18% of respondents, 2 points more than in April, and the highest share since December 2024, identify this as a top business concern. Only taxes ranked higher as a concern. To make ends meet, among owners surveyed, 36% said they had already raised their selling prices. And looking ahead, 34% of owners indicated they have to raise prices even further just to make ends meet. Beyond costs and pricing issues, supply chain disruptions had touched their operations in some negative way, and the labor outlook also has weakened. On hiring, just 9% of owners on a seasonally adjusted basis said they intend to add staff over the coming 3 months amidst the backdrop of rising labor costs, which are at record highs. On top of all of these challenges, the NFIB's statement flagged the Iran conflict and its impact on global oil markets as a central source of elevated uncertainty. Now, look, it's always tough being a small business owner, but no doubt about it, these are exceedingly tough times. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So the SpaceX IPO demand is hitting $250 billion. That's quadruple what the target was.
Boy.
Then we have OpenAI secretly filing for an IPO. Then that comes on the heels of Anthropic. Perplexity's talking about going public in 2028. And this is obviously a new world, a new tech world. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about innovation anymore. We're moving past that. We're moving past the funding stages into Wall Street. And what does that mean? Because this boom is coming, and it's coming very quickly.
Yeah.
Chris Alberta is the president and CEO of Principium Tactical Wealth Management. Chris, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Hi, fellas. Good morning to you.
What does this mean? It feels like we are entering uncharted waters at this point, particularly those that are playing the slots on Wall Street. What do you make of these companies all kind of going public at around the same time?
Well, certainly it's competition. I don't know that anybody knows what to make of it other than the fact that it does legitimately solidify the fact that AI is now the new version of the industrial revolution, if you will. I mean, $3, possibly $4 trillion plus valuations being made available to the public, is it kind of ratifies the idea that this is not going away whatsoever, despite the fact, frankly, that many of them are overvalued. If you just were to look at the books cleanly and say, is this worth what you're saying it's worth? Well, the answer would be question mark. And second to that, of course, is that they're not selling all of the stock. I mean, they're selling a fractional amount of the stock. And the question is, can Wall Street absorb that? Like, is there enough people that are willing to, in many cases, sell different positions that they have and other things that they've been holding in order to free up the money to go buy this? People don't just have, you know, billions of new dollars at the investor level.
Chris, you know, one interesting point in this story is that these companies are asking investors to believe in a future that hasn't fully arrived yet. How difficult is it for markets to kind of properly value potential instead of the actual profits?
Yeah, that's the entirety of it, Lloyd. You said it. You summed it up perfectly. You are making a leap of faith in the entire AI space, and many of these AI engines are very different, frankly, than SpaceX, which has a very physical manifestation to it. I mean, robo-taxis and Starlink and all the products that are driven by some of these same engines, but they're physically available to you. Many of these other companies are solely in the business of decision-making modules and super chips. So I think where you're hitting the nail on the head is you are making a blind leap of faith that this is not only the future, it is going to be the epicenter of the future. And that probably is the biggest opportunity, you guys, in this entire thing, is not those stocks in particular, but will be all the what they call the halo, the ring of stocks, smaller ones around all those companies, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, because many of them are hyper-dependent on SpaceX, for example, getting this massive funding because they have contracts that are unfulfilled. And when that happens, those smaller stocks, they could go skyrocketing while the big boys sit there for 6 months or a year teetering because they're all going to be unprofitable for quite some time.
I have so many questions on this. I do want to ask you about the policy side of this. Donald Trump signed an executive order earlier this month that would address potentially catastrophic cybersecurity threats that would be posed by artificial intelligence. There's been efforts that would curtail states in governing this type or providing some sort of oversight to this technology. How does the policy going to impact what we're going to see on Wall Street and people's decision to invest in this?
Boy, that's a fantastic question, Chris. I am in the camp of telling people that Wall Street does not really care. They don't bite their fingernails over what Washington, D.C. does, unless there's a massive piece of policy that could change something in terms of regulatory affairs. They don't care much. But this is probably going to be the most glaring problem that they face in the future, because as you're saying, if it becomes necessary to govern this thing in such a way where it can't get out of control and turn into some crazy sci-fi movie with a robot takeover of the world, right? I mean, it sounds so far-fetched, but at the same time, I mean, you have people driving robo-cars that are essentially, you know, they're missiles driving around. So if that were to happen and it severely impacts then or impedes the growth of some of these stocks, that is a real risk. I mean, policy risk doesn't come up often, but I think you're right. And as that levels up, and you can already see it with what's happening with states that have turned down completely the idea of having data centers there. And right?
Here in Michigan.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. When you look back, Chris, at past market moments, you know, the dot-com stocks, the crypto surges, electric vehicle booms, do you see similarities in the psychology driving AI excitement today?
Yeah, I don't know, Lloyd. I'm the wrong guy to ask on that one. I hate to give you a non-answer, but you know, the dot-com thing was in front of everybody, right? I mean, it was all the rage. It was a new thing. The internet, I mean, was a burgeoning science at that point. And it had, you know, the sky was the limit, but it got severely overvalued. And something has to have intrinsic value for it not to fall apart. I mean, you can't spend $1 trillion on something when the company's only worth $300 billion. Right, I mean, that's a huge deficit in terms of intrinsic value, and it falls apart. I don't see that happening with this. And you could trace NVIDIA back now for the better part of a decade, because if you're at the forefront of this thing, and we still are largely on the forefront, I think the mistake that I've made now a couple times, you think, geez, this thing has got to be coming to an end. But then a whole new layer opens itself up. And then before you know it, you look back 2 years and go, wow, that was just the beginning. This next layer could be even bigger. So I don't know that the psychology is wrong. I think we're in totally uncharted territory here. And 10 years from now, we might look back and kind of giggle at ourselves for being so short-sighted.
We just have the minute left here. And then, of course, you know, the old adage is buy low, sell high, right? But that doesn't seem to apply here. How do you traverse those waters with folks?
I think you have to probably buy high and hopefully sell higher. That's why I think that most of, you know, the accredited investors, the big institutional investment companies, they're going to buy gigantic positions in these companies because they're not going anywhere.
Right.
But I think in individual investors, unless they just came into a windfall or sold a property or something and have a bunch of money to put in a position that they know is going to be teetering and floating around and have jagged edges for quite some time, I think that they're going to make most of their money, if you will, on the halo of stocks that are supported by these bigger companies. That's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Chris Alberta, thank you so much. We appreciate catching up. We'll talk soon.
All right, boys. Have fun.
Yeah, you got it.
You too.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it feels like the Wild West to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Right?
It does.
And it, I mean, to his point, he's exactly right. Like, it's not going anywhere. And when you think that you've reached the mountaintop, you look up and you realize, oh my gosh, there's a lot more that I got to go. There's more there. There's more. There's more.
Yes.
Coming up on the other side, Jay DeBoyer, the Republican representative here in the state of Michigan out of Clay Township, is going to join us talking about the Kids RX program. It's next on JR Morning. All right, so I do want to give you a little bit of breaking news here on the Iran front. First of all, a senior U.S. official telling Fox News that 20 targets inside Iran were hit Tuesday night as part of that retaliation operation that was ordered after the downed Apache helicopter. Donald Trump told Jonathan Carl, "It's very important to respond. They shot down a helicopter, and we are responding. It is a very strong, very powerful response, and that's what this one is." Also, Fox News reporting now that the president has informed him that he is considering ordering new strikes on Iran. And part of this comes from a post on True Social, where he says Iran's military is a complete and total mess. Much of it, like the Navy, Air Force, doesn't exist anymore. Iran is in all talk and no action. The bully of the Middle East is dead. They've taken too long to negotiate a deal. That would have been great for them. Now they will have to pay the price. So, again,
the fire is no longer ceasing.
Maybe not
at this point.
And maybe your observation in that is correct. Now, Iran taking down this Apache helicopter, it would be the linchpin,
sure,
in this situation.
I agree.
The United States responded.
Yes.
But it does put these diplomatic talks that are in place in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are reports still that there are, you know, four discussions that are still on the books that are being planned, that are in discussion. But things seem to have changed over the last 12, 18 hours or so.
Yeah. He says they're taking too long to negotiate.
And again, that's something that we have been talking about for,
I mean, because that's what they do, right?
Quite some time.
That's what Iran
does. They've been hot dogging the negotiations.
Yeah.
And part of that is, again, Donald Trump's red line is that they would not have a nuclear weapon, that their nuclear program would go by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part of the memorandum of understanding that was released as part of these negotiations was that the negotiations on the nuclear issue would come after. That if we're able to stop the fighting of this,
right,
conflict, then we can discuss the nuclear after. And that has seemingly been a roadblock for the administration, for the president,
mm-hmm,
to go forward. Because it's easy to say, sure, let's stop this. Let's take out the blockade and let's open things back up.
Right.
But at the same time, if they can't even come to that agreement, what is propelling you forward to thinking that they're going to come to an agreement,
absolutely,
on the nuclear issue?
No.
Yeah, so we're going to keep an eye on that because things are changing here this morning here on JR Morning. Meanwhile, state lawmakers here in the state of Michigan questioned the founder of the RX Kids program during a hearing this month. This is a cash aid program for moms and to help support their babies. It is expanding across Michigan, but there is some pushback in the state legislature, and one of those is Jay DeBoyer, the representative for the Republicans out of Clay Township, and joins us this morning. Jay, good morning. It's good to have you.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you doing today?
We're good.
Let's talk a little bit about the program. What gives you pause about RX Kids?
Well, you know, initially, when I had first, and I go right all the way back a couple few years back when I heard RX Kids just as a monogram or a slogan, right? RX Kids in my mind immediately said, hey, we're going to set up some kind of a prescription drug program for children. And on face value, I was like, hey, if there's a needy child that, you know, maybe a family can't afford to cover some prescription drugs, maybe this could be a good thing. And that was the initial first thought. Well, then some details started to come out as time went by. And as it turns out, it has nothing to do with prescription drugs, and shame on me for believing that it did just by the name. But it's funny because a lot of people I've talked to have the same impression when you use the term. What it actually is, though, it's a guaranteed basic income for pregnant mothers and newborn children. And there's no questions asked. There's no means testing that's done, meaning that it doesn't matter what your financial position is. And you are, if you're 16 weeks pregnant, you're eligible for a $1,500 payment, and you're eligible for a $500 a month payment for either the first 6 months or the first 12 months, depending on the municipal jurisdiction that you may live in. What gives me pause is when we started to look into it and started asking questions, there were a lot of, indicators that started to pop up that this was much more than somebody's kind heart that was attempting to just take care of moms and babies. It's the entire organization is immersed in extreme left-wing ideologies. The members of the advisory board, the advocates are for a guaranteed basic income for all, which in my opinion, this is just the precursor to that. And then when we pressed the director on those specific questions and she denied it, well, then we went right back to her own words and played a couple video clips of her saying that her hope and her goal was that this will be expanded, and it will be expanded to children all the way to the ages of 18. And that we will, my hope is that we can continue to grow this program. So we're already at about $300 million in taxpayers' dollars that has been put out for this. And, let me tell you, if you think we're going to get to every child that's 18 years old getting this money, we're going to be into the billions of dollars. And you guys know what the ramification of $1 billion of liability in the state of Michigan is.
Representative, a new study published by the Lancet Public Health found Flint saw an 18% reduction in preterm births, a 27% drop in low birth weight babies, and fewer NICU admissions after RX Kids launched. When you hear those numbers, does that strengthen your confidence in the program at all?
Well, what's interesting is if you look at those statistics, those are about over about a 15 or 16 month period that that movement occurred. If you look at the trend line of that data, the trend line of that data was already in a downward trajectory prior to RX Kids, and it includes all babies. It doesn't just include the babies that received RX Kids dollars. So it's an anecdotal analysis. It is not a fact based. And if you look at other research that's been done, including research by a University of Michigan professor who took the same data that was used by RX Kids when they were justifying their movement in these directions in various different locations, they did an independent analysis and they came back and said they didn't see a movement at all of improvement of these dollars being dispersed. So I'm not necessarily jumping on one side or the other. I'm saying to you that the information and the viability of this program is not yet clear.
Is there a middle ground here? Because I think the idea, I've always questioned this program as well, and the money that is going towards it. Obviously there are people that are in need if they're pregnant or, and I'm all for people having those babies, right? But on the other side of that,
sure,
we need to find a way to make sure that they have some sort of resource available to them. But is there a middle ground to where the money isn't so high, that $1,500 and then $500 a month after that? Is there a way to kind of use the moniker of the RX Kids program to assist when needed as opposed to just paying out?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You realize there's somewhere between 15 and 20 already state-funded programs to take care of mothers, babies, food assistance, rent assistance, heat assistance, electricity assistance, diaper programs, obviously Medicaid, health. These already exist. The difference between RX Kids and those programs is that RX Kids has absolutely no guardrails on who is receiving these funds, meaning anyone is eligible, regardless of your income level. That, to me, is a problem, because if you believe we can put a bowl of cash on the table and only the needy are going to take it, you're kidding yourself. There is still a debate about whether some of these taxpayer dollars are being dispersed to people who are in our country illegally. Now, we're told that that doesn't occur, that we segregate the funds and we only use philanthropic dollars to take care of people who are in our country illegally. But we're yet to see the data that supports that. That's the statement. And you may wonder why I doubt the statement. The reason I doubt the statement is because when we pressed Dr. Mona Hanna in our committee and we asked her a number of questions, she was less than forthright in her answers.
Yeah.
She responded with answers that actually we then contradicted directly to her by her own previous statements. So that makes me further uncomfortable.
Sure.
Because if you look at what is going on with RX Kids, number one, you guys know what it's like to make an argument against pregnant women and babies. That's not what we're doing.
Right.
We're saying if taxpayers are going to shell out $300 million so far, and by the way, again, if this program became what they want it to be, it would be billions of dollars annually. You better have some parameters around it. You better not be doling it out to millionaires, and you sure as heck better not be taking my tax dollars and giving it to illegals in our country or in our state.
Representative Jada Boyer,
that's what we're most concerned about.
We appreciate it. Keep us up to date on this. We got to run, but we appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's Jade DeBoyer, represented out of Clay. It's part of our Capitol report here this morning on WJR. The Artemis 3 crew has been announced. What's their mission? We're talking about it next on JR Morning. So the astronauts for Artemis 3 have been announced. And look.
It's just excitement, man. It's exciting.
It's exciting because when you look at what Artemis 2 was about.
Yeah.
And the excitement that it generated and the fact that they were able to do things that we haven't done before. We pushed the boundary. Well, Artemis 3 is going to do the same thing. And I want to give you these names. Here is the four astronauts that will be sent on the Artemis 3 mission. Andy Breznik, Luca Pomerito, Frank Rubio, and Andre Douglas are part of this crew. And the goal is to test these lunar landers that are slated to carry astronauts to the surface of the moon during Artemis 4 in 2028. So right off the heels of Artemis 2, we're just boom.
Back up there, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Let's talk about it. Carlton Johnson's the CEO of the National Space Society and joins us this morning. Carlton, it's great to have you back.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you doing? Thanks for having me back.
We're great.
It was an exciting day yesterday because I think everybody's excited for Artemis 3. What was your impression of the crew? What's your impression of the mission as we push forward here?
Well, you know, I think that NASA, we said it at the beginning, I think that NASA's really doing a good job on selecting a balanced team. They've got a veteran spaceflight expert who has uncontested leadership. They have a test pilot with extreme experience as well, record-setting operational experience. All across the board, they've identified people who are the best of the best. And I think that for me, what stands out the most is that this crew really reflects what I think is going to be the future of exploration itself, because it includes government astronauts, international partners, operational experts and systems engineers. So that's really increasing how we're going to, as humanity, explore for decades to come.
Carlton, one fascinating part about this mission is that NASA is depending heavily on private companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin. Are we entering a new era where, you know, private industry is becoming just as important as government agencies when it comes to space exploration?
No, absolutely. You know, this particular mission is the first time that, you know, we are building direct integration around commercial spacecraft, looking at what the government has provided in the past and then leveraging heavily on the commercial side. There's, you know, when you look at the past, everything was pretty much a government operation with some things contracted out. Now, commercial space has a different play in this. And this is the way that I think we're going to do this moving into the future. I think it's a good thing because it helps the economy. It helps us do things the right way. And frankly, it helps us to leverage the experience and expertise that commercial space has to offer. So this is not only exciting, it's the smartest thing I think we can do.
Is competition, you think, accelerating innovation the way NASA hopes it will?
So here's my view. Competition is going to increase as we get more people into the market. Right now, you have a lot of the bigs that are playing, and I think that's okay for right now. But as we go down the road, you're going to start seeing more and more companies come into this sector. And then as you get more competition in that case, NASA is going to be able to look and say, this is what works best for us, but we're open to the idea of innovation. And that's really the key, because innovation is going to open a lot of doors. The space is hard. We have to think differently. And although we have 100,000 smart people at NASA, I'd rather have a couple million people behind the switch going, hey, what do you think about this?
Right. Yeah. Right. Andre Douglas is the only crew member making his space flight debut. That's a heck of a debut.
Yeah.
And he was one of the backup crew members for Artemis 2. And he said, he told NBC that one of the challenges was figuring out how to stay ready for that flight, but at the same time, you know, letting the crew do their thing for Artemis 2. So I think that's awesome. What is it? What exactly is the point of Artemis 3's mission here?
So the key thing is this. They're going to conduct rendezvous operations and docking operations. They're going to test spacecraft systems, evaluate procedures. And I also understand that they're going to validate the operational, let's just say, choreography that's required for the future lunar missions. So this, in many ways, is rehearsing what they're going to do to go to the moon. Again, I think this is a very smart thing. We used to do this in military all the time. You always want to practice before you go out. This is going to prove that all the things that they have lined up work together correctly. And then we can do it safely in low Earth orbit, come back down and, you know, correcting the issues if necessary versus being at the moon and having a problem. It's amazing.
Well, and this is going to be, I believe, a 2-week mission, so it's going to be 4 days longer than Artemis 2. And again, just pushing the boundaries with the best in the world. Great stuff, Carlton Johnson with the National Space Society. We appreciate your insight as always. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Yeah. You got it.
You know, and I think this mission also carries some geopolitical implications because, you know, China plans to land astronauts on the moon, they say, by 2030. So, you know, it's almost kind of like a modern version of the Cold War in space.
Well, yeah, there is an element of a race there.
Yeah,
for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. And this is something that we have been pushing towards for a long time. And all the while, I mean, don't forget, like, you got Elon, you got Jeff Bezos out there building landers for Artemis 3 to test. So it's a collaborative effort on this front as well. 8 o'clock hour coming up. Get you caught up on the headlines. Also, what's going on with the Dylan Larkin trade? It's next. All right, 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you. I want to get you caught up on what's happening with the Iran situation. The president announced major combat operations, remember, back in February 28. And this was U.S.-Israeli joint military operations. Since then, we've come a long way. We have a blockade in place in the Strait of Hormuz that has been particularly effective in crippling Iran economically. They have lost out on hundreds of millions of dollars every single day since this blockade has been put in place. And as a result, the ceasefire, which was hoping to draw some sort of diplomatic resolution, at this point, I don't know that we are in that zone anymore.
No, I mean, maybe on paper.
I mean, maybe currently.
Yeah.
Maybe at the very moment. But things seem to be changing. The president has said on social media, on True Social, that basically Iran is slow walking these talks. They could have accepted a deal that would have been beneficial to them, and instead they haven't. And the president telling Fox News, according to multiple reports, that he is close to ordering or at least considering ordering new strikes on power plants, on bridges. This is something that he had talked about earlier on, targeting this infrastructure. And that would escalate this to a new phase. And these are civilian targets, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
Which you start getting into the gray area, and maybe it's not even so gray, of, you know, war crimes targeting civilian infrastructure here.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is something that the president, according to reports, is considering.
Well, I mean, Iran has been kicking the can down the road. That's what they do. And it's to a point now that maybe the president feels like I have to do something to get them back to the table to let them know that we're really serious and we're going to negotiate this thing and get it done quickly. And maybe I'll have to, you know, order some strikes to get that done, to get them back to the table, to get them to say, okay, we will sign the deal. Because right now nothing's happening. And this is another thing, though, Chris. I know that in the beginning, Operation Epic Fury, we hit a lot of their, you know, places where they shoot the rockets, the rocket launchers. We hit missile depots, all of those things, and they were supposed to be depleted. The Navy's gone, all of that. But they're still able to fire rockets.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is still firing rockets. They're still firing. They shot down the plane. They're shooting at other areas, Kuwait. So they're still capable. It's not like they don't have the means.
No.
They might have less means.
Correct.
But they still have some means there.
Correct. And that was something that after the president had said basically that we've wiped out their military, we know now that wasn't the case. I mean, completely. We certainly have.
We know that we've weakened them.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said Wednesday that neither war nor peace situation must be resolved. According to the state news agency, the Islamic Republic news agency, Pezeshkian said that on state television that occasionally broadcast these remarks that Iran would not negotiate with the United States. He also said in later discussions that the former leader Ali Khamenei needed to resolve the neither war nor peace situation. The children of this country should be able to live with hope and a clear vision of the future. The government must fulfill its responsibility by creating the necessary plans to empower the younger generation to build the country's future. Meanwhile, Donald Trump saying that Iran will pay the price for taking too long to make a deal. So here's another piece. The Iran and foreign ministry saying that Tehran will need to reassess negotiations with the U.S. following this latest retaliatory strikes by the United States after Iran took down that U.S. Apache helicopter.
Yeah.
What happened last night demonstrated that Iran's brave armed forces do not hesitate when it comes to defending our country. Unfortunately, the United States is undermining this process through contradictory messages, frequent shifts in its positions and demands, and repeated violations of the ceasefire. That is nonsense, is what that is.
It is.
That is a brutal regime trying to frame a message, mm-hmm. and it's garbage,
mm-hmm.
is what that is.
Yeah.
And so the United States reacted to you shooting down an Apache helicopter.
Yeah.
That is not the United States undermining the process.
No. No.
Now, you want to say it was too strong of a rebuttal?
They're going
to
say
you
that.
Can make that argument, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the United States has repeatedly violated the ceasefire up until this point. So that's the latest on Iran as we know it today. It is changing minute by minute here as more information becomes available.
Folks in the Livonia neighborhood are breathing a little sigh of relief because a Livonia man accused of wearing a hazmat suit and attempting to break into homes appeared in court for the first time yesterday, following weeks of concern sparked by a disturbing security video. Now, 40-year-old Manuel Sarkis Badarjian is facing multiple charges, including attempted home invasion, assault with a dangerous weapon, felony firearm, along with misdemeanor assault and battery. He is also charged with possession of a controlled substance, including methamphetamine and Xanax. Investigators say the incidents happened in May when Bardagian allegedly tried to force his way into homes on separate occasions, including one case where he reportedly pointed a firearm at a 77-year-old victim. Police arrested him June 6 after a series of reports and video evidence linked to the suspect wearing a white protective suit and mask. In court, he was given a $250,000 bond, 10% required, and placed on a tether as the case moves forward. This was weird. This guy looked like he was in a hazmat suit with a mask on, and he was trying to get into people's homes, like get into the sliding back doors, and people chased him off, and he pulled guns on a couple of people and ran off. His attorney said that he had been in an accident in the past and had some head trauma, and, you know, maybe that was it. And, you know, they caught him with Xanax and meth on him and stuff, so... Yeah, it was weird. He would do it in broad daylight. And so people's cameras, you know, their home cameras would catch him. And, You know, and so there's something to it. But I know the neighbors are breathing a sigh of relief because when some of the neighbors they spoke to, when they saw who it was, they were like, oh, I didn't know it was him. I've seen him before. You seem
normal
okay.
guy. Yeah.
But, right. You know, so, yeah, they're breathing a sigh of relief.
The Artemis 3 crew has been announced. Luca Parmitano, Randy Bresnik, Frank Rubio, and Andre Douglas will man Artemis 3. Andre Douglas, how about this for a higher education path? You ready? He earned his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in 2008. Uh-huh. He completed 4 postgraduate degrees, a master's degree in mechanical engineering in naval architecture and marine engineering, both at the University of Michigan.
I told you, always a Michigan connection.
There's your Michigan connection.
I said it.
He's got a master's degree in electrical computer engineering from Johns Hopkins and a doctorate in systems engineering from George Washington University.
Wow.
Whew.
Man.
That's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful, man. My brain is hurting now.
And yeah, right. It's exactly. I can barely put those words together.
Right.
But Andre Douglas is going to be making his space debut as part of Artemis 3.
That's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Man,
cool.
That's great.
Yeah. It's going to do it for the Rocket Classic after this year.
Yeah, Rocket Classic leaving the PGA Tour. Tour officials, Rocket Companies confirming that the upcoming 2026 tournament scheduled for July 30 through August 2nd at the Detroit Golf Club will be its 8th and final run. Rocket Companies declined to exercise its option for 2027, citing imminent changes to the PGA Tour schedule and sagging attendance and difficulty drawing marquee players. The decision ends billionaire Dan Gilbert's 13-year run as a tour sponsor, an investment totaling about $150 million. PGA Tour says, listen, we still love Detroit. We want to remain in the market. We just got to search for a new venue and corporate sponsor.
Yeah, and part of that is LIV Golf, too.
Oh,
I
true.
Mean, has
oh,
played a role.
100%.
I mean, you've taken
yes.
away a lot of star players over yes. to that league, and they're struggling.
Yes,
they
got some issues too.
The Saudi PIF fund is not going to fund it anymore, so
that's
they're
right.
trying to find other avenues. And yeah, the golf landscape is certainly changing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that. Coming up on the other side, if you are excited for the World Cup like I am, we got the perfect place for you to watch these.
What? Okay. You said you're excited for the World Cup. That's fine.
Why did you look at me like
I'm
that?
Just
We're going to tell you where to watch these games. It's next on JR Morning. Well, coming soon is your premier spot to check out all the World Cup action. And it's happening on the West Coast. It's happening here in the United States. It's very exciting for most of us.
It is. Very exciting. It's exciting.
It is exciting.
It is.
Get excited.
I'm excited. Yay! Ole, 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 ole.
It's the Regal Eagle, and it's coming your way. It's the new sports pub and soccer pub on Verner in Southwest Detroit. And Keith Baldwin is the founder and owner and joins us this morning. Keith, it's good to have you.
Hey, great to be on.
Why start the Regal Eagle? What was the thought process behind this?
It kind of reminds me of the Regal Beagle.
Yeah, exactly.
On Three's Company.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in England. I didn't know about the Regal Beagle, so I didn't fully plagiarize, but lots of people have told me. But I came to the United States because of soccer like 28 years ago, and soccer's brought a lot of joy to my life, not just the game, but I've met great people through it. And one of the things about the game, like any sport, is you create a lot of memories when you watch together with friends. And I just wanted to create a soccer focused bar in Detroit. Detroit's got a massive soccer community, and even if you're not that into soccer, I want it to be a really fun place to hang out and create memories with people.
And you know, Keith, Southwest Detroit already has like a really strong culture and identity. What inspired you to open a soccer and sports pub specifically on Verner?
Well, I live downtown, so I know all areas of downtown pretty good. And as I was looking for a property, it just felt like the perfect one came up on Verner. It's right on the edge of Corktown and Mexican Town. And it's a great area. It was a great building. It had good bones. We've done a lot to it in the last month to get it ready for the World Cup. New parking lot, new back patio. Everything inside has changed. So it just seemed like the right area between Corktown, obviously all the soccer that gets played in the Mexican Town, Southwest area, and it's not far for anyone to get to.
I pulled your website up, And you've got a very familiar face to me. I am Italian, so I love the Italian national team as well as the U.S. national team. But you've got Marco Tardelli on there. Why include Marco on the website?
Well, our website is going live in the next couple of days. That's our holding page. But I just use Marco Tardelli saying you'll love our place as much as Marco loves scoring in the World Cup.
Nice.
Because if anyone doesn't know Marco Tardelli, just Google YouTube his goal in the 1982 final. He has a very famous celebration of just pure joy, and his body kind of gets taken over. And I think that's everyone's dream as a child, scoring in the World Cup final or whatever your sport is, winning the Super Bowl, achieving what you see as the ultimate in your sport. Like, his celebration embodies that for me. And I've always thought it's cool ever since I've seen it as a child.
And, you know, Keith, a lot of sports bars feel generic. What's going to make the Regal Eagle kind of stand out from every other place someone could go and watch a game?
Well, we have our focus. Our focus is soccer. We will be showing some other things. I mean, soccer's the priority, but we're happy to show Lions games. I'm a Lions season ticket holder. I love the Lions. We'll show them. We'll show Pistons. But we don't want to just show everything. Like, we made the decision not to show the Tigers and the Red Wings. We love them both. But like you say, there's many, many sports bars where that can be a focus. We want it to be soccer or some other sports at times. And then we have music as well. So we just want to, you know, stay in that vertical and really focus on what we think makes this a bit special.
What you mentioned the soccer fan. Soccer fans are, I mean, it's the most popular sport in the world. It is, I mean, soccer fans are different. Their love for their teams, it's very much like the NFL,
mm-hmm.
where you are diehard for your team. But soccer fans are some of the most passionate fans on the globe. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just rooted in your upbringing. You feel such a sense of family, such a sense of community. And we're not that different to all the other fans. You know, like those people who get up early and tailgate for 3 hours before mm-hmm. a Lions game. That's the sense of community. That's the sense of family. And in soccer as well, it's a bit easier, especially in Europe, to go to all the away games. You know, it's not like in America where you're traveling East Coast, West Coast. So you can really follow your team throughout the whole year. In these European countries.
When are you? I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish.
As I say, that's really the sense of family. You travel together, you meet up once a week together or more, and you go see your team.
And when are you hoping to officially open? And how close are things right now to, you know, behind the scenes right now?
We are officially open today and forevermore is the plan. We are open.
I love it.
We've been quietly open a few days. We're still doing a little bit of finishing touches. I'd say today we're about 85% complete, but we've got our big screens up. We've got drinks in. We've got lots of things ready to have people have a great experience watching the game. And over the next couple of weeks, we'll finish all our little finishing touches. But we are ready for the big parties. Today there's an England game at 4 o'clock. It's a warm-up game for the World Cup. And then tomorrow the World Cup officially starts, and we're looking forward to celebrating Mexico's first game at 3 p.m. tomorrow.
All right. Who is your team that you have grown up with over the years, and will we see a proportional amount of those games as opposed to other teams on your screens?
Well, during the World Cup, we'll show everybody. Yeah. I might cheer a bit louder for England because that's where I'm from, but right. I really hope the home countries, USA, Mexico, Canada, do well, so it's going to be fun. During the seasons, once the World Cup's over, we'll show a lot of the leagues. I am from an area of Crystal Palace in London, so mm-hmm. Crystal Palace is my team. So you'll see them featured a fair bit, but we're going to feature a lot. We actually just got sent a signed Weston McKennie shirt from Juventus. They're excited about what we're doing. So we'll show Serie A. We've got lots of cool memorabilia in the bar, and we'll show lots of different leagues.
Is that Juventus jersey, Visit Detroit?
Yeah, Visit Detroit helped connect us, and he signed it, and they sent it over.
Awesome. Definitely. It's going to be a great atmosphere. Nothing like a soccer bar for the World Cup. Keith Baldwin, thank you so much. Best of luck going forward. We know that this is going to be a wonderful thing for the city of Detroit, and we're so happy that you decided to go this route and open a great soccer bar here in town.
Thank you. Hope to see you down there.
Oh yeah. I mean, current fans and also some new fans.
Absolutely.
Will be
absolutely.
At this bar.
And again, it's like going to a bar and watching Lions,
yeah.
right? It's the same way. There's nothing like going to a bar
mm-hmm.
in a soccer venue and watching games on all the screens. It's fantastic.
And it's in a great spot. I mean, Corktown.
Yes.
In Mexicantown. I mean, there's a great spot.
All right, we're talking Dylan Larkin trade proposals next. It's JR Morning. All right. You know, this Dylan Larkin topic has been eating at me.
I know it has.
It has been.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you just love it for the story. If anything else, you love it for
drama.
The story.
It's the drama.
Well, there's drama, too, but, like, this, he grew up here. He's from here.
No, I get it.
He went through the whole system right here in the state of Michigan. And the fact that he wound up on the Red Wings and is, you know, wearing the C, it's a fantastic story. And we got two of them because of Aiden Hutchinson in this town.
Aiden, that's right.
So we got two of them. But Dylan Larkin, according to these reports, has asked for a trade. Nobody has talked about it publicly. Him, his camp, the organization, nobody. But then there were reports of a couple of teams that would be willing to maybe make a move for him because he is considering waiving his no-trade clause mm-hmm. for them. So he holds a ton of power in this situation. And one of the teams is even playing in the Stanley Cup Finals right now.
That's right.
So what does this mean? And is this something that's real? Helene St. James, the dean of the Wing Beat with the Detroit Free Press, joins us this morning to talk about it. Good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
So first of all, is this real, do you think? According to your digging around on this story, do you really think Dylan Larkin indeed does want out? And is he willing to remove that no-trade clause for a few different teams?
Well, he certainly has requested to be traded, absolutely. And it's not so much waiving the clause. It's him dictating, you know, telling the Wings, these are the teams where I want to go. We see that, you know, more and more regularly now with players who have no movement clauses. They get to decide where they want to land when they want to be traded.
You know, Helene, Dylan Larkin wasn't just another player. Just like Chris said, I mean, he was a hometown player. He represented the dream, really, of every Michigan kid who ever wanted to wear a ring wheel. Does this make this feel more personal to fans than maybe a normal trade request?
Well, I think what we can really, you know, look back on is just go back to February and the Milano Olympics. You know, I saw him. I was there covering the games after they won gold. I've never seen him look so happy that Sunday afternoon. And, you know, it was an incredible feeling, right? He hasn't known winning like this since he came into the NHL. And he returns to Detroit. And now, remember, in late January, so just before the Olympics, the Wings were in first place in their division.
Mm-hmm, right.
All they had to do was play 500 hockey, and they would have ended up with 97 points, and that gets you in the playoffs. Instead, he comes back to Detroit, and again, they fall apart in March, and again, they miss the playoffs. And it's now been, you know, 10 of his 11 years in Detroit where he has not advanced. And I think, you know, just being around those guys in Italy, the Tkachuks and such, you know, he probably realized, like, wow, it's so much more fun when you get to compete for something big.
Mm. What is the relationship between he and Steve Yzerman? There's been a lot of fan speculation. You know, he was critical last year after they didn't make a move at the deadline postseason. Steve Yzerman even issued some criticisms of Dylan Larkin during his postseason press conference this year. Was there animosity there? And even taking it a step further, you know, fans have been speculating, is this just Dylan Larkin trying to strong arm the organization to make bigger moves, to make them a contender, or does he indeed want out?
I think he does want out. I mean, I don't know. I don't think this is how you strong arm an organization. And as for the relationship, you know, I think it's good to remember, you know, it is a business. I mean, not everybody, you don't have to like the people you work for.
Sure.
You know, but there does have to be mutual respect. And yes, Dylan did say something after the 2025 trade deadline that we didn't do much, you know, but the guys that would have led to them doing something are the guys you can't trade. You know, nobody's right. going to give them anything in return for a fourth line or a third line or a third pair defenseman. So, you know, I think that was Steve's point. It's you know, he can't trade Lucas Raymond. He can't trade Moritz Seider. And those are the guys that would bring something, you know, that maybe would impress Dylan. So, you know, I think it was maybe unfortunate that happened. But, you know, overall, I mean, Steve did name Dylan captain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's, you know, I think many, many players maybe don't particularly like their coach or their GM, but
sure.
that's not, you know, that's part of the business.
Sure.
Like that's not part of it. It's
about winning for him.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You've covered this franchise for decades. We know that. Where does this rank, you think, among, you know, the most emotionally charged moments you've seen involving the Red Wings?
Well, in the past 10 years or something, it would certainly, you know, be way up there. It's funny because right around the time I started was when Keith Primeau wanted out, and we saw how great that turned out with the Wings getting Brendan Shanahan,
right.
Starting a cup party for the ages. So, it's very different these days. There's 32 teams now, and with Dylan deciding where he wants to land. Now, you know, the other part of this is Steve is not obligated to trade him. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the thing is, like, Steve cannot take a first-round pick or a high-end prospect in return. They have to have immediate value return in the players. It has to be somebody who can come in and plugged in on that top-line center. I mean, you know, if Dylan leaves, that's a huge, huge gap. They need to then bring in another center who can play on that top line. They already needed to upgrade on the second line center spot and a scoring winger. I mean, this is a crunch time for Steve in that respect, but he is not obligated to trade Larkin.
The three teams that have been named is Florida, Vegas, and Minnesota, and obviously Vegas playing for a Stanley Cup currently. Minnesota has been exceptional the last few years, and obviously Minnesota seems like they're loaded for bear. After that Quinn Hughes trade, is there enough on those rosters in a deal to make that immediate impact, like you mentioned?
I think so, and don't rule out Florida, because even though they missed the playoffs, I mean, Barkov was injured the whole season, so mm-hmm. they're going to come back and be an immediate contender next season. So, there's also, you know, you can involve a third team. You know, there's all sorts
sure.
of parameters you can attach to it. So, but, you know, it may also come to a point where Steve goes back to Larkin and says, you know, I need more teams or I need you to expand this list or it's not going to happen. So there's a lot in play right now. But Dylan is certainly an attractive asset.
Sure.
You know, he's going to be 30 next month. He's a consistent 30-goal scorer. He's a center, which is second only to a right-shot defenseman as far as what teams covered. So
yeah.
The problem for the Wings is just – that's a huge hole for them to plug and that they really need that in return.
Yeah. Helene St. James, thank you for your time as always. We appreciate
Absolutely.
Always catching up and we'll talk again very soon, I'm sure, on this issue, because it's not over.
No, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you got it. That's Helene St. James. And again, the production for Dylan Larkin, is he a first line center? Probably not.
No.
He is on this team because that's what he has
to be.
But, yeah. you know, you trade him to another contender, he's a second-line center, and he's going to man that line really, really well. They're going to be really strong.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're looking to move an asset to add multiple difference makers on your team, Dylan Larkin would be the piece to move at this point. And so we'll see what Steve Yzerman is thinking, because, you know, if Dylan Larkin truly wants out and Steve Yzerman is willing to make that happen – it's just the math's got a math.
It's got a
math. Right?
It's got to
add up. You got to get those guys in here that are going to be contributors. All right, coming up, it's Name That Tune here on Wednesday. It's Jer Morey.
Michigan summers mean outdoor adventure and fun, but high temperatures shouldn't break your budget. Count on Consumers Energy to help you make the most of this season and your budget with tips and ways to save. Making small changes, like shifting some energy use to the morning or evening, raising your thermostat or a couple of degrees, doing laundry at night or on weekends, can help lower your bill while keeping your home comfortable. Discover more ways to beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer.